From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we look at the ways two billionaire businessmen are leaving their mark on Detroit.
The downtown has become Gilbertville, and the area just north of downtown is on its way to becoming, you know, Illichville.
We look at rural poverty in Michigan.
Poverty is poverty, I guess, wherever it exists. It just seems that when we think of poverty, we tend to think more of urban poverty.
In a county like Lake, it's staggering to think that half the children, virtually 48%, are living below the poverty line.
A local news site shuts down. What does it mean for the future of news coverage in small towns?
I think that makes this a really fascinating time to be in this business because there is no clear answer to that question.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Cities all across the country have been built on some pretty big names, Rockefellers, Gettys. Here in Michigan, perhaps, it's the Kelloggs or the Fords. But currently in Detroit, there are two names gaining national attention, Illich and Gilbert. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, one downtown, two empires. What does it mean for a city to be so entwined with just two names? Then we turn from urban affairs to rural. More than 1.5 million people live in poverty in Michigan. Most of the headlines, though, tend to focus on urban poverty. Rural poverty is all too often overlooked. Why is that? That story later in the hour. But first, we're heading into the home stretch of summer, a summer that has surprisingly not seen the usual big ups and downs of gas prices. Patrick DeHaan is with GasBuddy.com. We've had fairly stable gas prices for the summer, have we not?
Well, relative to the last couple of years, gas prices have not eclipsed previous record highs. Although they have been bouncing around for a good portion of the summer, it's not the pain at the pump that we've seen in prior years, though.
Yeah, we haven't hit that $4 a gallon mark, I'm pleased and relieved to report.
You know, a lot of it traces back to what has been going on here in this region. Largely, prices not hitting $4 a gallon this year simply because the last few years, there have been some refineries that have been upgrading their facilities. That has meant less gasoline being produced in these months. This year has been the first time in the last, say, 5-8 years, really, that all the refineries here in this region have been producing gasoline without any sort of major upgrades taking place. BP's refinery in Northwest Indiana finally completed an 8-year upgrade that they had been undergoing, and that's largely the reason that we have failed to reach that $4 gallon mark.
Oh, no one's complaining about that. What about prices for the next few weeks as we kind of see summer out and get into fall? What do you think will happen?
That's right. As the summer driving season is beginning to fade, so too are gas prices now. We could see some volatility. Prices tend to be very volatile in Michigan, with prices jumping about 10 to 20 cents a gallon every week to week and a half. Not to get too much into it, it's a phenomenon called price cycling. So we will likely see prices spiking maybe a couple more times. By and large, prices will remain in the low to mid $3 gallon range. Today, Michigan stands about $3.45 a gallon on average, some of the lowest prices that we've seen since February. That will continue. Gone are the days of $3.80 or $3.90 or even $3.99 a gallon. More good news after Labor Day, and more so into mid-September, is when we can expect to see more downward pressure on pump prices, with prices in the low $3 gallon range. So barring any major hurricanes, which can impact gas prices, and some geopolitical tensions arising, right now what we're seeing in Israel and Russia, not really disrupting prices, but the potential is always there. So should be a quiet rest of the summer, barring any sort of unpredictable event.
Patrick DeHaan is an analyst with GasBuddy.com. Patrick, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
If you live in Michigan, chances are pretty good you found yourself driving I-75 at one time or another. How about this? Drive I-75 from Detroit to Sault Ste. Marie and stop at all the underrated sites your readers tell you about. That's what Detroit Free Press travel writer Ellen Krieger did in her guise as the Michigan Traveler. Ellen's with us now. Ellen, give us the challenge.
All right. We wanted the readers to tell us where to stop along the route between Detroit and Sault Ste. Marie that has an underappreciated or underrated attraction. And it had to be within 5 miles of the freeway. So we got hundreds of nominations, and then I set off on this four-day trip up north and stopped at almost everyone that I possibly could.
And then the readers voted on their choice for number one?
That's right. The number one winner was the Smiley Face Tower in West Branch. Now, people mostly know West Branch for the Tanger Outlet store there right off the freeway, but it is beyond that, and you can see it from the freeway.
That's that happy little face, but that almost went away, didn't it?
Yes, this water tower was built in 1974, and the smiley face got put on it by a local businessman. Spearheaded the effort to get Smiley Face put on there. And then apparently about 1999, it was in danger of disappearing entirely because they had to repaint it and they didn't have the money. And somehow the citizens came through and they still have their Smiley Face. And so when we ran our vote in the last couple of weeks, the citizens of West Branch all banded together and voted for Smiley Face, and that's one of the reasons it won.
What about some of the other of your favorite underrated sites that made that top 10 list?
I came up with a sort of 20 finalists, and then people, it was a little bit complicated. I had 20 finalists, and then people could rank their top 10. And so many of the things that were in the top 10 I loved. The second place of all is a Strait State Park in St. Ignace. A lot of people don't stop there, but they have a great bridge outlook you're looking from the north across at the Mackinac Bridge to the south, and it's a beautiful view and great pictures there. And number three was also in St. Ignace, the Castle Rock Outlook. Have you ever been there?
Never.
Well, it's been a tourist site since 1929, and it's a big, giant cliff I can't remember. It's like 175 feet tall. And they also have a Paul Bunyan statue. You can get your picture taken there. It's pretty kitschy, but I guess it's popular.
What surprised you most about this reader-directed journey, Ellen?
You know, the main thing is people love tradition. A lot of the things people nominated were not brand new things. They were old things, especially a lot of the food restaurants that people nominated or stores. A lot of the restaurants people know. I'm sure your listeners know Tony's I-75 restaurant. They're in Birch Run with the gigantic portions.
Oh, gigantic.
That was nominated by a zillion people. The Turkey Roost in Cocalin, that has been there for years, and it just serves turkey. So I was surprised that a lot of the attractions and the restaurants, people like tradition. That's what is most meaningful to them.
The story is at freep.com. Ellen Krieger, the Michigan traveler and the Detroit Free Press travel writer. Ellen, always good to talk with you.
Good to talk to you, too. Thanks.
And as you're driving around Michigan, you might have seen it. The bursts of autumn color. It's left many asking, what's up with these early bird fall trees? Chief MLive and FarmerWeather.com meteorologist Mark Torregrossa, are you hearing that question too?
I'm hearing it, and I'm also seeing it too as I drive up north to the cabin near Interlaken. Definitely, people are questioning, are the trees trying to tell us something about the fall and the winter?
And what does your weatherman spider sense tell you?
Well, I went to some experts, some tree experts, and talked to them, and they said that really what we're seeing is the stress in trees. And I had always been taught that the dryness can cause fall colors to come out early, but they're also telling me that the wetness that we've had in a couple of years can stress trees. And basically why you're seeing the fall colors is because the chlorophyll, the green part of a leaf, is going out of the leaf. Standing in a lot of water, trees can have that problem too, and that can force kind of a stress look too. So basically what I'm hearing from the tree experts is that the early color we're seeing is the stress caused from a drought a couple of years ago, the heavy flooding we've had in a few periods, and maybe even the cold, snowy winters that we've had. I'm seeing it a little more widespread and about 2 weeks earlier than what I normally see on some trees. And from my perspective, when I look at the weather maps, I see an early fall and early winter. So I wonder if the trees are telling us more than what the experts say on stress.
Interesting. And early fall and early winter, as in starting to get cool earlier than we want it to?
Yeah, and I don't know if I would use the word cool.
Uh-oh.
I'd maybe change it to cold.
You know, Mark, after what we went through over the winter, no one's going to be welcoming this news, I think.
Well, here's the thing. The cold pocket is up there in Canada. It's starting to build already. We've felt it. That's why we've had kind of a really cool July. That cold pocket is building, and the Great Lakes are about 7 degrees colder than normal. And the Great Lakes typically for our fall and early winter are a good buffering system from the Canadian cold. If that buffering system is 7 degrees colder, we got to imagine that the cold air, once it slides down, will have a much easier time getting here.
Hmm. So we're gonna watch those trees, and as you say, let's see if the trees really do know something that we don't know.
Right. And we've got one other thing that we can talk about at some point that will be a big implication in the winter, and that is El Nino and its progression of whether it's developing to a weak, a moderate, or strong El Nino. We need to wait about a month or two to see on that, but that's going to be a big player in our winter, whether we go toward a little bit warmer or stay extremely cold.
So about the time everybody heads back to school, and just after Labor Day, we'll check in with you and see what El Nino's doing.
Okay, that sounds great.
Mark Torregrossa, Chief Meteorologist for MLive, and of course with FarmerWeather.com. Always good to talk with you, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All the headlines surrounding Detroit's bankruptcy and its many problems have tended to focus our attention on urban poverty. But a recent series in Bridge Magazine challenges us to look beyond the cities, look to those struggling with poverty in rural communities all over Michigan. Bridge Magazine writer Pat Schellenbarger is with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we say hello to Jane Zender Merrill, the Kids Count Project Director with the Michigan League for Public Policy. Good to have you back, Jane.
Thanks.
Pat, what would you say was the mission statement of your series?
Well, poverty is poverty, I guess, wherever it exists. But it just seems that when we think of poverty, we tend to think more of urban poverty because that's where you tend to see it most often. You know, if you drive through Detroit or Flint or some of the other cities in Michigan, it's right there on the street to be seen. But in rural areas, it's nearly invisible. You have to really get out on the back roads. But the fact is that the poverty rate is higher in the rural areas of Michigan than it is in the urban areas. If you are poor and you live in a rural area, it's harder to get access to services, if they're available at all.
What do the numbers tell us? Give us a sense when you say the rates of poverty in rural areas are higher than that of urban areas. What do the numbers tell us?
Well, there are 13 counties in Michigan, according to the Census Bureau, with poverty rates above 20%. I believe 11 of those are rural counties, largely rural, and many of them are in northern Michigan.
Jane Zender Merrill, from what you've seen at Kids Count, tell us, how do the challenges of being poor in a rural area, the day-to-day challenges, how do they compare and contrast with being poor in a city like Flint or Detroit?
Well, many of the problems are the same. Transportation is a big issue both in our urban areas and in the rural areas. It just translates differently. There's public transportation systems in the city, but they rarely meet the needs of working people, especially who work evening or weekend hours. In the rural areas, you have the problem of not having any alternatives by and large, and not very safe roads, a lot of time blind curves, two-way roads, dirt roads in the countryside, and families with low income cannot afford very reliable cars. And then you have the constant cost of gas, which has been up and down close to $4 for many months at a time. So that's a huge issue. And many of our more affluent areas in the northern Michigan and in the UP, the housing prices are too high for low-income families to afford. So they move further out. So they have more of a drive to get to a job because there's more likely to be jobs in the more affluent areas. There are different problems, but they're similar in many ways. The transportation, the cost of housing, the isolation, these are all similar. They just sort of play out a little differently depending whether you're in an urban core
or whether you're in the countryside in northern Michigan.
Pat Schellenbarger, you wrote for your series in Bridge about poor people who live in wealthy rural counties like Livingston and poor rural counties like Lake County. Did you find the safety net differs depending on which county you live in?
Yes, Lake County is one of the highest poverty rates in Michigan, over 23%. And maybe unlike some of the other counties, the poverty in Lake County has been long-term and chronic. Mm-hmm. People there have struggled for a long time. Livingston County has the lowest poverty rate in Michigan, according to the Census Bureau. Yet even in Livingston County, there are people trying to make ends meet. The poverty rate there is something like 6.3%. But the poverty rate among children has gone up, even in those affluent counties like Livingston, because of the recession. More people lost their jobs, homes were foreclosed upon, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it has raised a question, at least in my mind, what's worse for a child, to be growing up in poverty in an area, a county where nearly everyone is in poverty, everyone they know, or to be in a county like Livingston and be the poorest kid in the school and not be able to have what the others have? So we wanted to make that point, that even in the most affluent areas of Michigan, there are people who are below the poverty line.
And Jane, what do you see in your experience in terms of mental and psychological problems that come from that? It's a great question that Pat posed.
Well, we're seeing a lot of children, a lot more children, and rising rates of children coming to the attention of Children's Protective Services in our rural counties, much higher than the Michigan average, and it's been steadily going up, really, since the recession was supposed to be over in 2009. So clearly kids are suffering as their parents try to cope with surviving during high unemployment. In a county like Lake, it's staggering to think that half the children, virtually, 48%, are living below the poverty line, which is an income of around $23,000 for a family of four with two kids. And we've seen escalating child poverty in our more affluent counties, as Pat mentioned. In Oakland County, it jumped by a significant amount over the trend period that we were looking at from mid 2000 until just after 2011. So we're seeing rising rates of poverty in our more affluent counties as this sort of leaks out from our urban core, and people in the rural areas are not improving. Well, virtually all counties in the state have seen declines in affluence and economic security, and it has persisted past the economic recovery. So families with children are not participating in this recovery. And at the same time, we're cutting back on some of the programs like unemployment insurance, the Family Independence Program, and even food stamps. We're putting more restrictions in place while families are still struggling to get through this.
And I want to make sure that we do talk about that. Before we do, though, it raises a question about the kind of education that a child might get. Would a child, even though they're living in poverty, but they're in a wealthier county, let's say Livingston, would their education, do you believe, be better than kids who are going to school in Lake County?
You know, when I look across the it's hard to separate out, because the economic status of the family and of the community has such a huge impact on how kids do in school. And kids that come to school hungry, who haven't had a good night's sleep because their parents dropped them off somewhere so they could go to work and then pick them up later. I mean, there's all kinds of ramifications to families when they don't have enough money to make it week by week and month by month. A lot more families are working part-time temporary jobs, and their own economic future is uncertain, and that plays out into children's lives. So kids come to school already compromised. I mean, we can do a straight chart with school district versus low income, and it matches pretty much across the board. It's the best predictor for how kids will do in school. I know that schools have been under a lot of pressure, and some schools have been able to make superhuman efforts to help these kids achieve on standardized tests. But the fact remains that kids that are hungry, kids that are living under stress all the time about where they're going to put their heads down the next night, they really have difficulty when they come to school to be
functional learners and excited about being there.
We're talking about the challenges of rural poverty in Michigan as we talk with writer Pat Schellenbarger, who did a series of stories on this topic for Bridge Magazine. And we're talking with Jane Zender Merrill, who directs the Kids Count Project for the Michigan League for Public Policy. Pat, one of your stories is titled, Along Michigan's Back Road, Thousands of Homeless Children. How many thousands and why are there so many homeless kids in rural Michigan?
Well, in just that one area, that was a four-county area of Ionia, Gratiot, Isabella, and one more, I can't think. But the point was that in that one area, the person, Brenda Greenhoe, who is under a federal grant, goes out and looks for the homeless children. Last school year, found 1,550. To me, that's staggering because these are rural counties, and the fact that there are that many homeless. Now, it's important to note that homeless doesn't mean simply living out under a bridge necessarily, although some were living in tents or cars.
Mm-hmm.
She even found a student living in a dugout at a baseball field. But under the federal law that authorizes this program, homeless could mean living temporarily with friends or family and or couch surfing. And I think that's a big part of what Jane is talking about, is the instability that goes along with that. You know, of never knowing for sure where you're going to be next week, next month. By the way, that was one of the bigger issues that we wanted to look at, was not just the fact that there are people out there who are poor, but how it affects them. You know, looking at health indicators and academic achievement. And generally, you would find that in lower income counties of Michigan, life expectancy is shorter. There are higher rates of smoking, diabetes, obesity, and other health issues. And Jane, when I interviewed her for this, about the problem of toxic stress and how that affects children.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does. It has a great deal of impact, I believe, on how they perform in school.
And then through the rest of their lives, because Jane, I have to imagine that toxic stress, it just leads to that inherent outlook of hopelessness.
Right. I mean, they actually can chart this now with these brain scans, how children who are constantly in a state of siege because their parents are stressed, they don't have a lot of nurturing, their parents are distracted. And what happens is that the brain itself gets bathed in a chemical that keeps the child to a point of always feeling under a flight or fight response.
Under siege.
Under siege. So kids can't learn and they can't sort of relax when they are always feeling as if they're not safe. And I think that's a lot to do with economics. I keep going back to economics because parents get stressed, and particularly for young children, that has a lot of repercussions because they don't have a lot to buffer themselves the way older children do as they get exposed to other children, other families, in a broader neighborhood. But we have big issues in Michigan with not only family poverty or household poverty, but concentrated poverty, where we have many children who may not be living in poverty themselves. Their families may have income above the poverty level, but because there's so many people in their community who are living in poverty, the resources aren't there, the connections aren't there, the hopefulness isn't there about future. So they are equally disadvantaged as children who actually live in poor households.
Let's talk solutions as we wrap up. And Jane, you pointed out very skillfully, so many of the support programs have been trimmed back, restrictions put on them. What do each of you believes needs to happen now on an immediate basis and then also on a long-term basis to really address the needs of the rural poor? I'll start with you, Pat.
I don't think there are any easy answers to any of it. I think it's a very complex problem that we face, but most solutions do require more money. It's easy to say more jobs, but how do you create more jobs, especially in a place like Lake County, where their biggest employer was the prison and it closed a few years ago? But it would require a concerted effort, I think, by social service agencies, nonprofits, churches, by business and others to come together and come up with some solutions. And it would require maybe shorter-term solutions, like some good case management to work with families to help stabilize them, get them on their feet, get them education, and help them qualify for the jobs that they're going to need. So I think it's a whole combination of things, including public assistance, but more than that, more than just perpetuating generation dependence on government handouts. That has to be part of it, though.
And Jane Zender Merrill, final word for you.
Well, one of the keys that we think would make a difference is raising that earned income tax credit so that families who are working, who are struggling to make it and don't get enough hours or don't get a high enough pay to make ends meet, would have access to the earned income tax credit here in Michigan. It was at 20%, and it's been reduced to 6% of the federal tax credit. We also firmly support increasing the minimum wage. People who work hard at a job, show up at a job, should be able to work and make enough money to support themselves. And we also would advocate for making improvements in our infrastructure, like roads, which would generate jobs. So while we have this economic downturn and the private sector is not expanding at the rate we need, we definitely could use this time to invest in our infrastructure.
Jane Zender Merrill with Kids Count from the Michigan League for Public Policy, and Pat Schellenbarger, whose series of reports on rural poverty in Michigan can be found at Bridge Magazine. Just go to bridgemi.com. That's bridgemi.com. Always good to talk with both of you. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Poverty and homelessness can often go very closely together. Veronica Riddle ran away from home as a teenager, and she says during that difficult time, there was one thing she found especially helpful.
When I was young, when I was 16, I ran away a lot. I actually ended up staying in a runaway shelter in Royal Oak. It was scary, and I felt very lost and alone. The reason I was running away was because of traumatic events that happened to me when I was a child. The thing that really made an impression on me when I was at the shelter, not only was it the staff members, but it was the volunteers that were there. The thing that I lacked when I was younger was time. Like, I didn't have someone to come home and talk to. I didn't have someone to, I mean, my mom worked a lot and whatever. And I didn't have someone that I can go to and talk about my day if I was having a good or a bad day. And the people there, they made that time to sit down and actually chat with you about life, about, you know, silly little things. And the one person I remember was a volunteer. It was a man. And he would toss the ball with me. He had I don't remember if it was red or blue baseball cap. And I just remember he was at the end of the driveway, and I was towards the back of the house. It was a really long driveway. And I remember him just tossing the ball to me. And every time he tossed the ball to me, he'd say, "So how are you? What's going on?" And then he would tell me what an arm I had. You know, I had a really good arm. That have I ever played? And it brought on, like, have I ever played sports? Do I want to play sports? Well, what do you like to do? You know, stuff like that. And I just remember him, his mitt was just always, like, right here, and he had this smile on his face. I can't remember what he looks like, but I remember his voice and his hat. That's all that I remember. I remember in my head I'm thinking how amazing it was that someone who doesn't get paid to come there, how amazing that it was that he came there just to have a conversation with a girl that is a troubled girl, and how he took the time to find out what her hobbies and interests were. And I just felt like it was just amazing. But looking back now, like, I treasure that. It taught me how, like I said before, it taught me how precious time really is.
Veronica Riddle is a mother of four. She's working on getting her bachelor's degree and works at a shelter for homeless and runaway kids in Mount Clemens. That story was produced by Michigan Radio's Kyle Norris. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What is the future of news gathering on a truly local level? That's what people in Ann Arbor are asking, with word that the Ann Arbor Chronicle, an online news site, will be ending regular publication next month. September is also the Chronicle's six-year anniversary. Mary Morgan is co-founder of the Ann Arbor Chronicle, along with her husband, Dave Askins. Mary, why pull the plug now?
Well, 6 years is a long time to be doing as much as we did. We have been talking about it for probably 6 years, whether we had the stamina to do something like the enterprise that the Chronicle is. And so we felt like we had been doing a very strong job, but we had just reached a point where we didn't feel like that was something we wanted to do anymore.
Could you have kept it going if you'd wanted to? Meaning, was there enough support from advertisers and from readers to keep the Chronicle going?
Yes, it wasn't a financial issue. There was no crisis, no financial crisis that precipitated the decision. We really could, and I think David wrote this in the column that announced the news, continue indefinitely as long as we were willing to put in the amount of effort that it took. And that was really the question for us. Do we want to be doing this 5 years, 10 years from now? And the answer was no.
Was there no way to bring in other reporters and other news people to maybe lighten the load for you and Dave a little bit? They're available.
Well, that's the question that we get asked. People say, well, could you have used interns? Could you have used more freelancers? We looked at what it would cost us and the revenues that we would need to raise to get to that point, to comfortably be able to bring people on and take the load off us. And the question was, we knew a strategy of how to get at that to that level, and we just didn't really want to. Fundamentally, I am not a salesperson, although I did have responsibility for the advertising. And we were shifting more of our, as a percentage, more of our support, revenue support to subscribers, which was good. But I just really wasn't interested in taking that on and the effort that it would have to take in order to get us to a revenue level that was sustainable with a staff. And also, I was a manager at the original Ann Arbor News, and I think I'm a pretty good manager, but that's not what I love to do. And so that was another factor in that as well.
The Ann Arbor News, of course, closed down in favor of that digital print version, so it morphed. That was in 2009, and as you say, you were business editor there. And I'm wondering what all of this says, that if the Ann Arbor News is now morphed into this reduced digital print version, and if you feel that the Chronicle was just too much demand, now what? I mean, what is the future, do you think, of true local news for cities like Ann Arbor?
Well, I think that's a question that everyone is asking and trying to answer. And I think that makes this a really fascinating time to be in this business because there is no clear answer to that question. And frankly, in a certain sense, I don't really care about a lot of the pieces of news that, for example, sports coverage or the spot news crime, a lot of the feature entertainment stuff. I think that's going to be handled in different ways, and that'll sort itself out because there are a lot of eyeballs and there are a lot of advertisers that are interested in that space. But what I am concerned about is local government, and that's really what we made our bread and butter, and we got a very strong response to that. Somewhat to my surprise, when we first started out with the concept, mm-hmm. people were – they couldn't imagine that that would be something that would be sustainable. But I'm concerned about the future of that, and I think that there's a parallel concern with civic engagement. And I would like to figure out maybe what kind of a hybrid could evolve that would address both of those issues. And that's really where I'm interested in spending some energy.
How many unique visitors did the website draw every month?
We drew between 40 and 50,000 a month.
So there is an appetite out there for this local news.
There is an appetite for it. And I think that it's really proof of concept in a lot of ways, what we did, that if you're committed to it, if you're in perhaps we had a particular community that was motivated and interested in that particular topic, and I don't know if that would translate to other communities. Maybe it would. But yes, it's something that I think that people are interested in, and that's one of the cries of distress that we hear now, that what's going to happen with that kind of coverage that we did, the in-depth coverage of a lot of government entities that weren't covered before.
And really, it's a story, as we know, that's being repeated from across the country, where local news isn't getting the in-depth coverage. And at what price do you feel that we pay as local news gatherers wither away?
Well, I think there's far less engagement. And I think it's a question of what comes first. Do you have the information out there and that's what causes people to get engaged? Or do you have the citizens demanding it and that's what brings it from the news organizations? I really wish there were more clamoring for that kind of coverage. I hope that the people who are upset that we're closing are also going to clamor for that and that something else will evolve, more coverage as opposed to less coverage. I sort of fear that without us there to push the other news organizations that they might just drop off the minimal coverage that they do have. So that's something I'm going to be watching too.
Do you think this presents opportunities for the youngsters coming out of journalism school and out of writing programs, maybe with a different look at news gathering and news coverage?
I would hope so. I haven't seen as much of that as I thought I would. I think it's difficult for people who are just starting out in the community. They've probably been trained by traditional journalists, and I'm not sure that that's going to be the best kind of training for them. We didn't do, I think, what a lot of people would call traditional journalism. We did, in some ways, more research projects or white papers. We had very much a fact-based, this is what happened. We didn't tell stories. We didn't collect quotes. We very much based it on what was happening in the world and our observation of it and description of it. And I think that's very different. We appealed more to librarians than I think journalists in terms of people who wanted to do the kind of work that we did, which is interesting.
It certainly seems as you look ahead that you and Dave are not going to be divorced from news and from caring about what's happening on that governmental level. You're just going to try to find a way of doing it that doesn't suck up all your life, right?
And first, I would stress that we're going to try and take a breather.
and am I correct that the day that the AnnArborChronicle.com is going to end regular publication is also your wedding anniversary?
It is indeed.
All syncs up very nicely, doesn't it? Mary Morgan is co-founder of the AnnArborChronicle.com news site, ceasing regular publication on September 2nd after 6 years. Mary, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
History has seen a number of corporate heavyweights do their part to try to revitalize Detroit. One of many examples, Henry Ford II. He powered the Renaissance Center from blueprints to skyscrapers towering over the riverfront. But there are two names that stand well above the others, the names of Illich and Gilbert. Detroit Free Press business writer John Gallagher explored the impact of Mike Illich and his family and of Dan Gilbert in a recent front page story entitled One Downtown, Two Empires. Welcome back to Stateside, John.
Well, thank you very much.
And someone with a very keen sense of Detroit's history is here with us. John Moak is a law professor at Wayne State University, where he teaches courses on property, energy, land use, and urban development. Professor Moak, good to have you with us.
Well, thanks. Good to be here.
John Gallagher, as you were researching and writing this big front page piece, what was it about the Illiches and Dan Gilbert that most struck you?
Well, as you mentioned, you know, there's been other corporate chieftains who have done a lot in Detroit. You know, Peter Stroh and Pete Karmanos and Al Taubman and Max Fisher and Henry Ford II and, you know, Roger Penske. But Dan Gilbert and the Illich family, between them, are not just doing, you know, individual projects or two or three projects, but almost entire districts. You know, Dan Gilbert now owns or controls several dozen buildings in the greater downtown, including, you know, a good number of the classic skyscrapers. And the Illich family, of course, with their plans for the Arena District, are going to plan to redevelop this entire district of several dozen blocks. So you have almost the downtown has become Gilbertville, and the area just north of downtown in the Fox Theater District and to the north is on its way to becoming, you know, Illichville. And so the fact that you have these entire districts each covering either dozens of square blocks or dozens of buildings really struck us as something that's worth exploring.
John Moak, tell us, how does the impact of Dan Gilbert and of the Illiches, how does that measure up to the way that tycoons and moguls have helped shape other American cities? Where do they stand?
Well, they have the potential of having an impact in the future that might be somewhat comparable. To me, I have not seen any other two major civic leaders, corporate leaders, accumulate as large a percentage of land, have a significant amount of holdings in a major urban center, as have Dan Gilbert and the Illich organization. I think Dan Gilbert has been reported to have control of as many as 60 buildings downtown. With an estimated 9 million square feet, that represents a very large, a very substantial percentage of the occupiable standard buildings in the core, central core of the city. But frequently, there's a comparison made to Pittsburgh and to the Carnegie Mellon engagement there, and they had very great impact. And in case of Andrew Carnegie, his industrial development not only impacted the center of town, but the town as a whole, since he provided a economic base for the entire city. That is not the case currently with the Illich and Gilbert holdings. They're having significant effect on the downtown area and the midtown area, but the ripple effect has yet to grow and spread out into the rest of the city, which is 140 square miles in size and is really struggling to maintain stability.
And that's what I wondered is, as you looked at this big picture for your piece for the Free Press, John Gallagher, how much of what's happening in that downtown area because of Dan Gilbert or the Illiches, how much is that really impacting people in the neighborhoods of Detroit? I guess, in other words, can predominantly black residents in struggling Detroit neighborhoods, are they benefiting from what two white billionaires are doing downtown?
Yeah, well, great question. And John Mocha is absolutely right that so far we haven't seen it ripple out much beyond the immediate downtown. Corktown is getting some of these new people who are moving downtown to work in, you know, in Gilbert's buildings. The North End near Woodward, north of New Center, is getting some spinoff benefit. Places like West Village are getting some spinoff. But by and large, it's still confined to sort of the greater downtown, although it's still pretty early in the game. And Gilbert only moved his company downtown about 4 years ago. And, of course, the Illiches have been here for longer. But this arena district is still entirely on the drawing board. It's nothing, you know, they haven't broken ground on it yet. So it's a bit early. But, you know, the question of what good does a strong downtown do for the rest of the city, I mean, that's debated here and elsewhere, and I think it's a really important question.
I'd like the thoughts of both of you. These are indeed civic-minded business people, but they are not in it for charity and warm, fuzzy feelings. These are billionaires keeping a real close eye on their bottom lines. Are they using their wealth to help the city of Detroit, or are they using the city of Detroit to ultimately help their wealth? Professor, your thoughts.
Well, clearly, a revitalized downtown is of great benefit to the city. The only question is, to what degree will it that those benefits be spread throughout the city? But certainly, you would want a revitalized downtown to begin to make progress in rebuilding the neighborhoods. And a revitalized downtown will begin to attract investment from outside the city, will begin to attract businesses to consider moving into the city. And so it certainly is a place to start. I think Dan Gilbert himself has said that he's hopes to do well by doing good, and so far it appears that that's the approach and that's the effect that's taking place. He's been buying buildings for less than $30 a square foot. Now, what that would tell you is that there aren't other people who are interested in taking those buildings over and putting them back into productive use if he could buy buildings at that low a price. And so putting those buildings into use, creating jobs in rehabbing the buildings and creating space for new businesses to move in and for him to move his company staffing into the buildings is a very positive thing. And it would seem to me that at this point, all indications are that what Dan Gilbert is doing, and if the Illich project is able to be successful, what the Illiches are doing will be of benefit to the city. And the only question is, to what degree will it impact the overall health of the city as a whole?
And John Gallagher, you noted in your piece for the Free Press that Dan Gilbert's developments tend to not involve taxpayer subsidies, but certainly the same cannot be said of Illich projects.
Right. So far, Dan Gilbert's mostly buying property on his own. He's gotten a few benefits or subsidies on some things from the city, but he's mostly doing it on his own. And the Illich family, like most development in Detroit, I mean, let's be fair, has gotten pretty significant, you know, subsidies or incentives, or they've used alternative financing. And typically, almost any project done in and around downtown the last 25 years has had as much as 50% or more of their financing coming from either some sort of tax break or some kind of, you know, historic tax credit or some kind of subsidized loan fund or something. I mean, some kind of non-traditional financing. So the Illiches are certainly in that realm, but, you know, almost everybody else is too.
We've seen Mike Ilitch in the last couple of years at Tiger Games, broadcast of ceremonies at Tiger Games, and it's certainly clear he is moving well into his 80s, and he's not going to be doing this forever. Is the family carrying on the tradition from what you can see?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, their son, Christopher Ilitch, has been CEO now for the past several years, and, you know, it's seamless. It's a family business. You know, they will certainly carry on when Mike is no longer able to. And, of course, I think Mike's going to go on until he wins the World Series, at least, which we were hoping was this year. But I think you'll expect to see the Ilitches be major players here for many, many, many years to come.
Professor Moak, ultimately, what do you believe will be the ultimate legacy of the Ilitches and Dan Gilbert?
Oh, I think they'll be viewed as being major contributors to the revitalization of downtown and the Midtown area. And hopefully their legacy will also include effects that those projects will have had on the economy of the city as a whole. That remains to be seen, however.
And your thoughts, John Gallagher?
Well, I think that in the ideal world, you'd probably want to have a whole bunch of people redeveloping the city and not just, you know, two individuals. And, of course, there are many other people redeveloping it. It's just that the contributions from the Ilitches and Dan Gilbert are just so overwhelming that they sort of dominate the scene right now. But I think that I certainly think if they carry out all the plans that they've talked about, as John said, it will be viewed as very positive for the city in the long run.
Detroit Free Press business writer John Gallagher recently profiled Dan Gilbert and the Ilitches for a front-page story in the Detroit Free Press. And John Moak is a law professor at Wayne State University, where he focuses on, among many areas, property, land use, and urban development. Thanks to you both for speaking with us today.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Next time on Stateside, Barry Township, a close-knit, quiet West Michigan community with a very beefed-up police department.
Where do you go when your Humvee breaks down or your armored military personnel carrier breaks down? And who trains these people to use these things? I mean, these are not toys.
The militarization of a small-town police force, next time on Stateside. Stateside was produced and directed today by Allie Billings. Our engineer was Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, and Brianna Tinsley. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.